Recent interview with Mr. Thomas J. Carney Jr. from the Youngstown State University Oral History Project dealing with the Mahoning County Democratic Party. It's being done in the Liberal Arts Building, Youngstown State University. The date is March 10th, 1975. It's approximately 10:20. Okay, Mr. Carney, would you please talk a little bit about your background, your family,
neighborhood, educational, occupational?
Well, first of all, I was born on the south side on Hudson Drive, 3130 on Hudson Drive, which was about two doors from Sheridan Grade School. So I started my first 3 years in Sheridan School in Youngstown, and then I went to St. Dominic's, graduating from there in 1948. Then I went on to Earthland High School, graduating from there in 1952. My dad at the time, from about 1942 until he passed away in 1965, was Mahoning County Commissioner. So during those early years, even before I became a teenager, and then as a teenager, government, anyhow, not so much politics, but government was sort of something that we lived with, because it really was bread and butter to our family, you know. Like you said, your uncle was in the grocery business. Well, my father was in the business of politics and government. And my father came from an Irish section of Mahoning, Youngstown. They used to call it Kilkenny. And that was where all the Irish, when they came over, they settled in a place called Kilkenny, which was really around Williamson Avenue. And most of my grandfather was a puddler in the mill. And he died at a relatively young age, and my father started working in the mill, I think, around 13, in order to help sustain the rest of the members of the family. So that's the kind of beginning, and I suppose that we all have to start from some point, some cultural point, to find out, you know, what makes us tick and where we start.
Does your father ever talk about how he got involved in politics?
Well, my father was active in the in sports, and he was promoter of the Golden Gloves. And prior to the Golden Gloves, now that started back right after the end of World War One. My father was a Marine in World War One, and boxing in those days, around World War One, prior to World War One, was pretty good sport. And I suppose it's because you could put a lot of people in it. You know, everybody had to compete with one another, and it's a one-on-one, and it was a kind of competitive sport that most anybody could participate in. And so my father was active in that. Story is that my father came home. I used to do a little bit of boxing, and his claim to fame was he was not refereeing, but he was being a second for a fighter, and the fighter failed the show. He was fighting a pretty good contender, so my father jumped in the ring to take his place, and the fellow's name was a fighter by the name of Kid Solomon, and my father beat Kid Solomon, and I guess he knocked Kid Solomon out. But my grandmother objected to boxing and sports, and so she made him give her his word that he would not continue to box. So he didn't box, but he got in the business of training fighters and then promoting the Golden Gloves and this kind of thing. So the Golden Gloves in sports gave him the name recognition that helped him when he ran for office. Now, he'd run for sheriff back in the late 30s, ran for clerk and was defeated. It was probably at that time maybe 10 candidates running for sheriff. He ran for clerk of courts in the late 30s, and he lost by just a handful of votes in the primary. Both of these were primary contests. But then I think the third race that he was involved in was the county commissioner, and he won that, and I think it was around 1942. And he kept that until he died in 1965. So that was, that was the kind of background that he had. And my mother was born in Niles, Ohio, a place called Wethersfield. And she was raised in her early days on a farm. And my grandfather was he used to sell sand and gravel to contractors. And they came from rather farm kind of life, and then they moved into the city of Niles and lived across the street from the McKinley Memorial. But she had, they had really no political background of any kind. And my grandfather and that side of the family owned a couple of houses and would fix them up and rent them. And I suppose in those days, collecting rent and odd types of ways of making a living prevailed. I don't know what else my grandfather did except that sand and gravel banging on some property. But ultimately, he was not a wealthy man. So neither side of my family really had any financial wealth at all.
Okay. What was your first actual venture into politics?
Well, my own personal venture, I suppose, came after my father died in 1965. My father made a statement, when I had expressed him an interest in politics, he said, "I don't know why anybody with a college education would want to get into politics, you know." And I really felt bad about that because I was looking at it from the point of view that we really need professional people and this kind of thing. But, I suppose he'd seen politics in Youngstown from the 30s, through, and there was probably a lot of things in it that he didn't particularly want for his son. But in any case, it was too late because probably had been bitten by the bug. I remember as a little kid, I was going out and putting up signs, on the telephone pole as we did those days, and did a lot of work to try and get him elected. And so I ran for a state central committeeman, which was part of the old congressional district that was represented by Frank Bowe, which had the southern part of Mahoney County, and then we went down to Canton. And I ran third in that Democrat primary, and I really did get a good vote from the Mahoney County section. Of course, I didn't get a big enough vote to overcome Canton and Stark County, and I was a newcomer down there. So that encouraged me to run for township trustee, which I did do in, 1969. And I ran for that office and was elected. And then I decided that I should try for the legislature. The district that was the old 83rd district had been changed a little bit to give it a few more Democrat votes. So I felt that I had a 50-50 chance of being elected. I ran for the office and was elected.
Okay, go back a little bit here. When you attempted to become a Democratic State Central Committeeman, was there a type of campaign you had to run for this position?
Not really. The State Central Committeeman would represent that county or that congressional district at the state level in maybe setting some state policy. Whether state policy is really set by State Central Committeemen is, I think is dubious. I really don't think that they do. But it was my idea to get started and get something rolling, and it happened to be a position that was available and where I wouldn't, step on anybody locally, local toes, so to speak.
Before this, you were Mahoney County committeeman, right?
Yeah, I started as a precinct committeeman, right?
Right.
I don't know. I suppose I've been a precinct committeeman since 1960, I would suppose, maybe a little bit later than that.
How did this come about?
Well, the person who had the job wasn't going to run anymore, and I got the word, and someone said to me, "I can't recall who. Why don't you run for precinct committeeman?" I said, "Well, all right." So I went on the ballot, and nobody else went on, So I really have had it to myself. It was a competition.
Is that the way it usually is?
Yeah, it's probably, unfortunately,
What do you attribute this to, that there's such little
interest?
I think that
we have a lot of people that get interested in politics, in and out. It's a flash interest that comes and goes, and there's a lot of impatience with the party routine of precinct committeemen being elected to that and then doing your job at the precinct level. But they overlook the fact that the precinct committeeman is really their accumulated vote, determines the policy of the local Democrat Party. And so when there's no interest in precinct politics, no interest in terms of people getting involved and wanting to take a part in it, then there's no interest in making any change. Because it's very easy for a county chairman, as an example, to, you really have to kind of beg people to get involved at the precinct level. And so, the county chairman who is elected by precinct committeemen can almost pick people who he wants in the precincts, so that really he sets himself in, as county chairman, and he really had no threat unless someone would launch an you know, a campaign to change a significant number of precinct committeemen in terms of changing the structure of the local party.
So that's what's happened here.
So that's what's happened here. And that's why you really don't see change.
And you personally, how do you view this?
Well, I believe that, you know, there's probably two schools of thought. You know, sometimes, you know, you think a vital party would be one where there's a lot of people participating, where nothing is cut and dried, where, you know, where the party has to respond to a lot of people. And sometimes that school of thought leads you to the ultimate conclusion, though, that when it comes time to making decisions, that the decision that's made comes through a lot of bitterness and argument and controversy and ends up with a fractured kind of party versus one that's dominated by maybe one person who really can generate unity and strength and the things that are necessary to keep a unified party together to win a November election. So ultimately you get to the point is, you know, is the thrust of a strong party leadership better politically, and it probably is. Just like as an example, when you say, you know, if you're judging it on success, then you have to look at Mayor Daley's operation in Chicago, and he gets reelected. He has a strong political organization, and he is a key man. And they keep winning elections, and they do it because they have a structure which, you know, even local precinct committeemen can respond to local problems, you know, fixing streets or providing services to people. We don't have that kind of a structure here, you know, to that extent. But we do have a pretty strong party, but it really doesn't have very broad participation.
You point out that, you know, this strengthens the party, this type of operation, but what does it do for the constituents?
One of the problems is that it, you know, if it isolates itself and becomes, it's restrictive not so much by choice, but because of apathy, you know. In other words, nobody's fighting to get in. Nobody really wants to join it, so it's left to go pretty much by itself. And what happens then, I think, is because there's no competition, and there's nobody really looking for the job, that it brings about an apathy within the organization, too. You know, among the participants there, and probably that's the biggest problem that we have right now, is that the city has changed, many of the people have moved away, and it's very difficult to get those that are remaining to be very enthusiastic, I think.
So you think a competitive body at this point would be good for the party in this area?
I think that the competition at the precinct committee level would be an advantage. I think that, you know, if we had more people that were interested enough in politics, that interest would be shown by running for precinct committee and getting involved at the precinct level would be a good thing for the party, because it shows interest and enthusiasm and all the rest. I think, but, you know, the Democrat Party has much less a problem than the Republican Party. You find the Republican Party, you know, I don't know if they had 50% of their precincts, where there was any, you know, people even wanted to run for the job, you know, even uncontested, they had to appoint precinct committee people. I suppose it's an example of the political system being turned off by people. I think that one of the things is that Americans don't have time for politics. I think that's one of the big problems, is that they just won't take the time.
Well, you held a job, you know,
right,
like Nicholas. Mm-hmm. Did you find it being sort of like a burden to be involved in politics and also the whole
job? Well, not being involved in politics is not a burden. It becomes a burden when you take a public office and try and do two at the same time. You know, when I was president of the Mass Transit Authority, as an example, and I worked full-time at McNichols, I had received a check from the Mass Transit Authority, and I was working full-time at McNichols. And I found myself, you know, doing things for the Mass Transit, spending time on that at no cost to the taxpayers, not collecting a salary, and I was taking time away from my job, which was not a fair thing. And a lot of times you find that the people that are engaged in other areas are subsidizing government because they are giving up time from things that they should be doing to make a living, and they're giving it to government because they, you know, they're interested in government, they want to see, and it's a challenge and this kind of thing. But, you know, if you find a good, dedicated city councilman and has a job doing something else, a school teacher, whatever it might be, you find that he has to make a lot of sacrifice in personal time to do both of those things and do them well. So we have a lot of dedicated people in government, even, you know, today, as much as you hear about how bad it is, I've been around a long time in business and then in government and a little bit of both at the same time, and the quality of people in politics, by and large, I found to be extremely high. Now, you know, we have some places where we have weak public officials, you know, there's no question about that, but overall, and by and large, I found them to be pretty strong people, or they wouldn't be able to jump out of society and assume the responsibilities that they do in government.
Back to the precincts for a second. You mentioned that you think that competition at the precinct level would be good. What about the other party leaders? Do you think they would approve of this sort of action?
Well, I think that it doesn't make any difference whether they approve or not. I think that party leaders feel more successful when they have activity and when they can generate activity, because they get concerned when there isn't any, because then it's much more difficult for them to get things worked up for a campaign. So I would say the party leaders, you know, although, you know, it might make it easier for them to maintain their positions, by the same token, they do like to win elections, and they do like to have that enthusiasm. And, you know, we come from an old school here in politics in Youngstown, with Mr. Soligan, been chairman for a long time, many, many years, since what, the 40s, I think. And he has been it comes from the school of a strong political leadership. And you don't really survive in those positions very long, and unless you've had the ability of keeping your house in order in terms of being able to generate the support to keep that position. And he's been able to do it throughout the years because of successful elections. You know, now, in the last 6 years, I suppose, since Jack Hunter has become mayor, there's been a question as to whether or not we can generate enough enthusiasm in Mahoning County to take and become a strong political party in terms of being able to take a seat from a very capable man from the other party. And it has been a lack of interest on the part of candidates, you know, to want to try someone who is a good candidate, who's done a relatively good job. So we're faced now with an inability to get candidates, facing a strong opponent. There are many Democrats in the present administration, as an example. Probably most of the cabinet, if not all of them, are Democrats. So you have like a Republican mayor and a quasi-Democrat administration, really. And you have a majority Republican city councilman in a majority Democrat city. So Republicans that have come into office have, you know, kind of forgotten their partisanship and have just said, well, we're going to call shots the way we see it and get along with everybody, and they've done that, and it's been very successful for them to do it. I think Democrats have had difficulty in handling that because they have to go back to the same old party structure. You know, you have a Democrat mayor, then you have all Democrat employees, and really there's not much room for the other party when that, you know, in the Democrat administration. So I think that the independent voter now has kind of struck out, you know, in terms of forgetting about party labels and have gone looking at men and individuals and administrations, and it's kind of a new ball game in the city of Youngstown. And I think that's why we have such an inability to handle this administration politically.
Well, what do you think this is going to do in the future for area politics?
Well, I don't think it'll do anything different, you know, in the future here than it will do any place in the state. I believe that there's a certain area for party politics in order to keep a strong political system, two-party system. So I think that's always going to be, you know, part of our makeup. I don't think at the local level nearly as much at the state and at the federal level. It's kind of ironic when the last figures come out that only 18% of the people in the country are supposed to be Republicans. And Republicans just had a meeting where they were talking about whether they should broaden their base, or conservatives say, no, don't broaden your base, you know, be conservative and express that. Well, the fact of the matter is that if you look at the successes of that 18%, it's not too bad. You have a city of Youngstown that has a Republican mayor, Cleveland, Columbus. You know, you can go right through the major cities in Ohio, the Republican mayors. The governor right now happens to be Republican. The president of the United States is Republican. The legislative bodies are oftentimes Democrats. Because the public has kind of made the decision that maybe Republicans are better in the executive branch and Democrats in the legislative branch. I don't know whether that's true or not, but Republicans seem to have less people. When they get into the executive branch, they seem to have less pressure than Democrats do. They don't get, seem to get the pressure from labor groups, as an example, for pay increase. You don't have, you know, Democrat Party is supposed to be the party that responds to labor. Republicans get in, they really have a lot of, you know, they don't seem to have the same kind of pressure. At least this is my feeling, you know, because maybe it's that they feel that the Republican administration is an adversary and they're unsure and they're afraid. You know, they don't try the Republican administration like they would try a Democrat administration.
You mentioned the party routine here. First the committee man, then move up step by step. Usually it's a fairly long process. You made it rather quickly.
Mm-hmm.
What do you attribute this to?
Well, my name probably had a lot to do with it. You know, you have a political name that you don't have to go out and try and sell your name. It's already been sold by other people. My father, you know, I think he was elected about 10 years before Charles Kearney was elected to the Ohio Senate. And his name was merchandised because of his activity in sports, you know. So sports, you know, his name in sports and his activity gave him recognition, public recognition, so that when he ultimately won in 1942, then you add the political effort on top of the sporting effort, it just makes it more recognizable. And then for someone like me that comes along after my father, you know, it makes it much easier because the name recognition has been there. So you have to credit that to name recognition, and certainly you can, you know, you can mess that up. As a, you know, I can destroy that, or some other current could destroy it, you know. But fortunately, everybody with our name has been, I think, just tried to be responsive and has been pretty successful politically.
Well, do you ever get the feeling like you don't want to trot on certain ground because it might hurt the name?
As a kid, you know, I remember we used to go down there, not we, but the kids used to play a lot of pool in the 40s, like the 48, 49, 50s. There's always a couple pool rooms around. And that time, the police used to raid pool rooms, believe it or not, to get kids around their 16. And I can remember, I was always afraid to go in pool rooms, see, because I didn't want to get caught, because I didn't want my father to get a bad name because of me. Because, you know, I was always I was always very conscious of protecting the name. And I suppose maybe that runs off too, you know. But, so I was very conscious of that. And I think that just shows a little bit of pride, though, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that.
You mentioned your father said he saw, you know, you assume he saw a lot of things here he didn't like about politics. That's why he didn't want you into it. Have you seen anything in area politics that you especially do not like?
Well, sure. I think that campaign financing is very difficult. You know, we have, you know, so-called super contributors, you know, the contributors that give extensive, you know, vast amounts of money to campaigns, and can almost bankroll a whole candidacy. And we passed some campaign financing laws in the state of Ohio last year, which I played a part in. And it was my hope that, you know, we may be able to, you know, try and put an end to, you know, big contributors determining who's going to be what because of the amount of money they put into campaigns. And I think this is a, you know, a very difficult thing to handle. And there are a lot of people that like to participate through their money, you know, that they, not necessarily that they determine policy or they want that much to say, but it's just that they have money and they like to get involved in politics. Like some people play the horses, I think, right. Some people like to get involved in politics. And they like to make a name for themselves because they are contributors. And the ordinary citizen will not contribute. I've gotten, some small contributions here and there, and even maybe $100 from different people that, really were interested in me because they think that I can do something. By and large, campaigns are financed by large groups of people, and so if you're a politician, you have to decide, line up your constituency and your money so that your conscience at some point in time isn't going to come back and, put you in a whiplash. So, because this is a labor community, I suppose labor participation, financial participation is a good thing because it's money that comes from, that everybody, all the working people in this community have put into their campaign funds so that the politicians that they vote for and elect and they endorse are going to go down and look after their interest as working people. And when you come from a district like that, you can line that kind of thing up without too much difficulty. I think it's when you get into some of these other areas where you would want to question, you would have to question it. And it hasn't been a problem for me at this point. But, if you go higher, it becomes a concern to me as to whether or not a person will be able to raise the kind of money that he needs to get further ahead without making a compromise that he might not want to make. And what I hope, is that decision does not have to be made in order to move higher, that you have to compromise and take, finances to finance your campaign from sources that you don't want to take it from, or to make commitments that you don't want to make.
Now, as running for state representative, you said you didn't really feel this sort of pressure, this willingness from big contributors to help you out. Now, when you were in the Congress,
House of Representatives,
working on this thing about campaign financing. Did you feel any pressure there from these big contributors?
No. Mm-hmm. No. Labor was involved in, But your big interest group, big lobby groups, I'm talking about the manufacturers lobby group and, every group that's going, they had an interest in it, the professional lobby groups. But I don't have too much trouble with that whole group of people in that, they make their name, everything is published, their names are published, it goes on, goes on the record. And for instance, different businesses, different group associations have a fund, like the bankers, they have I forget what they call it, but they have a fund where they contribute, and from that fund they contribute to candidates. But they have to, the names of the people that contribute to the fund has to be made public and this kind of thing. I don't mean that kind of thing. I mean that other stuff, that cash that might flow that you can't pin down. You don't know where it's coming from. Or that the public don't even know, was involved in a campaign. We go unreported and this kind of thing. This is the stuff that has to be stopped.
Like maybe a midnight visit from a certain representative of some unknown people who would, wouldn't be interested in this type of legislation.
I don't know. I can see, when you get down there and you start looking at the process, you can see, a person down there could, sell himself without a question. If a special interest group was interested in a certain piece of legislation, you yes or no vote, somebody comes down with a bag and starts handing out cash. That can happen.
Does it happen? Have you seen it happen?
I have never seen it happen. And, when I look at the people that I'm working with, I have an awful lot of confidence that if it happens, it's only happening with a very few, very, very few. Most of the people, if they have commitments, they might represent organized labor 90% of the time. But then there's always that time when they go against them, they buck, their main source. I've seen it. And it, really kind of... it gives you confidence, that these people, when you think even the people that sent them there basically were funded their campaign most of it, that they have enough, they do have enough nerve to say, I think you're right 90% of the time, but this time I think you're wrong, and I can't believe it.
What are usually the consequences of that sort of action?
Usually the people get mad, that's a labor thing, they'll get mad, but a couple weeks later they forget about it, and they go on to other issues. Because you're there, and they That I've never seen it last very long.
Well, have you ever found yourself bucking labor?
I did. Mm-hmm. In one vote regarding unemployment compensation for school people. I felt that it was the right thing to do. So.
Well, did they know prior to the vote which way you were going to vote?
I don't know if they did or not.
But they didn't contact you on the issue?
Well, they contacted me on the issue before.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for example, who would call you and talk to you about this?
Well, when it comes to labor issues, they have they have a number of labor lobbyists in Columbus that are there all the time. The Teamsters have a representative. The operating engineers, as an example, is working very hard this past week to get Governor Rhodes' bond issues on the ballot. The FLCIO, building trades, they're all there. They have a representative.
What type of pressure do they usually apply?
Well, it's just that they let you know how they stand. Okay, if a candidate is supported by organized labor, they endorse him. They endorse him usually based on his track record, if he's been there before, voting for labor issues. So the candidate is trying to find out how labor thinks and, what effect it has on the working man. So he's interested in finding out what labor's position is. So it's kind of a two-way street. Now, you might find a point where politician or the legislator who generally supports labor issues, it's like, well, I don't think that's not really good for the working man, ultimately. That the person that's doing the lobbying really might not be right, and that's when you find a confrontation. So,
now when you went against labor on that particular issue, did any from the local Democratic Party get in contact with you?
We never have any problem from the local Democrat Party. They never interfere with the way we vote. The only time we hear is regarding voting rules and regulations as it relates to the Board of Elections. I've yet to have the county chairman come to me and tell me to vote any way at all. In other words, he's really taking a hands-off position. He lets you do your job, and he stays out of it.
Well, then what way would you have continue your contact with the local Democratic Party if it wouldn't be on issues? What areas would you keep up with communication?
Well, most of it is party, party problems. If you're a candidate, getting the literature out and keeping the party strong, getting the committeemen to up to date on issues, what's going on. They have to hear your voice too. So we try and inform the precinct committeemen so they can inform people in their precincts on issues, especially issues that are partisan issues. And that takes communication, so you have to go in and talk to them. You want to keep your kind of chairman informed on those issues also.
How well informed do you think the Mahoning County committeemen are? This wouldn't relate so much to you, is how informed do they make themselves?
Well, I think some are well informed and some are not very well informed. Depends on their interests that they have. I think you'll find a committeeman that's really interested in this job, that he's pretty informed about what's going on. And there's others that are really not too interested in their job, but somebody has to do it, and they've been recruited, and there's no enthusiasm on their part. They may not know. That's why I think, if you can get enthusiasm with the committeemen, then they become better informed, and then they can talk to other people in their precinct about issues.
At this point, what would you say would be the rule? The enthusiastic committeeman who gets out and informs, the people in his precinct, or would you say you have... more or less lackadaisical. Now, this particular area, we've already talked about them in general.
Well, I think that you're talking about all of Mahoning County, you have to say the majority of them are enthusiastic and are interested. Because we really don't have a problem with filling our seats so much, Now, there are, but I think a majority of them are enthusiastic and interested. But there's another group that, they don't really relate their job as a committeeman to being informed on issues and things like that. They kind of, I think that they have an interest in politics, but it's more of an interest in the candidates, and some of the other things that go on.
Well, do you...
But it's very difficult, for anyone to sit down and really get a good fix on that.
But, would you say, or Mr. Sulligan, call these people up and say, hey, the people in your precinct aren't reacting the way we thought they should, or something like that. Do they ever get on them?
Well, I think that we have a system here where we have captains who have a number of precinct committeemen, and it depends on who the committeeman might respond to or where the information is picked up from. But if we would find that a certain precinct committeeman isn't doing his job, you know, we would kind of respond to that. The candidates who are running for office would try and get into that somehow or another by maybe using another person to be his spokesman in that precinct, for example.
You wouldn't contact him directly, usually.
It would depend. I may, but then again, if I felt that he couldn't do the job for me, I would probably use some other source. And running for office, you know. So it's not something that really happens. But, I mean, I can't ever remember running into a problem in a precinct committee where I have to go to somebody else in the precinct to get the job done. You know, you hear about things happening in certain precincts, small number. But, I mean, I have never really seen it myself.
Do we have any maverick precincts? Democratic mavericks?
Well, I suppose we have a couple that don't follow the mainstream all the time, but they're very far in between. And generally speaking, you know, the committeeman might have a different philosophy than the ordinary Democrat Party, or he might feel that, you know, the party apparatus is old, and this is the old school and the old way of doing business. And I've seen a couple of those people in Mekong, but when the campaign is on, and, you know, when you really start to hustle, they put their shoulder to the wheel just like the other committeemen, and, you know, they get the literature out, and they follow the same procedures that everybody else did, and eventually, I think they come to the conclusion that, you know, precinct politics is joining hands with another precinct committeeman to get the candidates and get the Democrat Party across, and that's the best way to get your philosophy across. And they said it, kind of forget about philosophy in the precinct level because it's the candidates that express the philosophy.
Now, you talk about this, would this be in a general election as, say, opposed to a primary election?
It could be either one, but I would say general, more, you know, you would see it more. Oftentimes you might find different precinct committeemen supporting different presidential candidates in primary. Mm-hmm. You know, and the local party might take a stand. But, you know, I can remember that there were some precinct committee people for McGovern and some for Humphrey and some for Jackson. And, you know, I think the party supported Humphrey here. But, you know, they didn't all, you know, the party took a position, but they certainly all weren't on the bandwagon at that point in time.
Do you ever recall the party, the central committee, saying, this precinct man is not good for us and let's get him out?
No, I've never heard that. Never been around when anybody's ever tried to. I'm not saying that, you know, someone in a precinct, as an example, might be a party activist of some sort. He may not be a precinct committee, but he might say, well, this guy isn't doing his job. He might say, well, I'm going to run against him, or, you know, might try and get somebody else to run against him. I'm sure that happens in different circumstances, but as far as starting from the top, down, I've never heard of it at all. I think the county executive committee and chairman try to stay out of precinct wars. You know, if there's some satisfaction in the precinct, I think he takes the position, let the precinct try and decide for themselves on who's going to be the committeeman. You know.
Okay. A point on when you were running for board of township trustee. Originally, your candidacy was disallowed by the Board of Elections. What was this all? What was the involvement here? What was the story?
Well, a lot of times, you know, you think you can have the Board of Elections and you can accept their word. You know, one of the workers down there, their word that they're going to give you all the facts on how to be a proper candidate. Well, I went down and I told them I wanted to run for trustee and that I wanted to get the petitions. And I wanted to know how many signatures were required. So they gave me the petitions and they told me the number of signatures. I can't recall what it was, but as for example, let's say they told me 125. So I went and had the petitions typed out and notarized and everything and started circulating them. Well, I found out later that the number that they had told me that I needed certified signatures of registered voters was incorrect and I needed more. So I went down to the Board of Elections and picked up some more petitions. And I took them back and had them typed in and everything else. And I had them circulated. Well, the girl that typed the petitions typed the date on which she typed the petitions, you see. So that there was two separate dates on the petitions. The first set was, let's say, was typed for August 5th, and the second set was for August 10th. Now, law says the petitions are supposed to all have the same, you know, be the same, because it's the first petition is it, you see. So when I filed my petitions, but there are two separate different dates on it, see. And the Republicans and the Democrats in the Board of Elections split. The Republicans said that I submitted two sets of petitions because of the different date, neither one of which had enough, see. And the Democrats said no, that the law has said that you know, an error of this type should not rule you off the ballot, you know, that the girl put, she didn't put the original date on. So they went to the Secretary of State, who was a Republican, Ted Brown. He ruled favor of the Republicans on the board, see. However, the prosecutor, Kearney, was a Democrat. He told the board that he could not defend them in a lawsuit. I went and got an attorney, and he told the board, you know, court precedent and everything, put him in a position where he can really defend them in their position. And so then the party, you know, then the Board of Elections acquiesced and allowed my name to go on the ballot. And you see, you know, these are some of the very shabby ways that can be used to put a person's name off the ballot. And it's funny coming from a political family that you get into that. But that wasn't all that happened. So I ran for office and I won. And when I filed my expense return, I filed my committee and my own on the same form. You know, I was really trying to be super honest, you know. Every nickel and dime was accounted for, and I really wanted to be super honest. I took it down, and I filed it, and a couple of days later, the opponent that I had beat came back, and he wanted to have the job vacated because I didn't file the expense sheet properly. And I evidently should have had one form for the committee and one form for myself, you see. And nobody told me down there, you know. And I didn't go to a lawyer to get all these things worked out. I thought, you know, person ought to be able to run for office without having to go to a lawyer to figure out how to do it. And that was never pursued, and it really, I had really been super careful to do, you know, to be honest and get all the contributions out, and there'd be no question. And then you have those little technicalities thrown up at you. So you learn, you know, by those kind of things. But you also learn as a legislator that you want to try and change the law to make it as easy as possible for people to run for office, and to get rid of those little technicalities.
Do you find it difficult to change the law in that way?
Well, not so much in that way, is that, but it's very difficult to pass laws. You know, just don't go down there. You have 99 House members and 33 senators, and you get a majority of them, first of all, think an issue is big enough for them to spend their time on, and then to talk them into voting for it. It's not an easy thing, you know.
Again, when you ran for township trustee, what were they spending? How much did it cost to run?
I think I spent about $1,100. I think I raised about $500, $500 or $600 from a card party or something, you know. And I spent about $600-$700 of my own money out of my own.
And where would most of the expenses go?
Well, most of them went to direct mail. I had a thing put together and mailed them, direct mail.
How large of a staff did you have working for?
Oh, I suppose I had probably 25 people working on the campaign, you know. Most of them were housewives, that, you know. A lot of volunteers on election day worked for nothing, you know, on election day.
And how much of this staff carried over to when you ran for district representative?
Well, a sizable amount carried over, and then add on, you know. You add on different people from different communities.
And what were the expenses of this campaign?
That campaign was about $11,000. Big difference.
And again, where would most of the expenses go for that?
Well, about $3,500 of that came from state Democrat headquarters. Democrat Party had made an effort to gain the legislature, and they did go about raising a lot of money. And so they gave us about $3,500. Got quite a bit of money from labor, individuals that made up the difference.
And what would your expenses be? What would you?
I didn't spend any of my money in that election.
And where did this money go as far as purchasing what, or in what way did it help the campaign? Where did you put the money in?
Well, a lot of it went to Deck Mail again.
Okay, we'll talk about it.
A lot of it went to newspaper advertising and some radio. And I don't know, you know, you get matches and handouts and things like that. But probably newspaper and Deck Mail are the largest single amount. Direct mail, you know, is very expensive now. It was expensive then, but it's even more expensive now. It's almost prohibitive now.
Okay. That was a pretty big time here for you, that. And that that you were elected chairman of the board of trustees.
Right.
That was in January 72. Was there anything involved in becoming chairman as opposed to, say, just becoming a committee man?
Well, when you're chairman, you know, you had to be elected by two Republicans and you're a Democrat. So when I became a trustee, I tried to call the way I saw it and not, you know, not be a partisan and not to be part of the solution, not part of the problem. And I think I did earn their respect and respect of the people in the community in working with them. And so I think they took that approach. And I carried out my job the same as they would. Really, you know, township trustees gives you the privilege of really not operating in a partisan way, to be honest about it. And it's kind of very refreshing kind of work, you know, because you just do it the way you think is best, and you don't really have partisan considerations. And I think the other two trustees were acted pretty much the same way. They were Republicans, but I believe that they were not overly partisan at all. I think they were just, you know, we really got along well, and I think during that time the township, I think they had some confidence in their government, and I think the people were pretty well satisfied. We did pass a levy to put some policemen on firemen at that time. And I think when you have that does show that the people have confidence in their leadership.
In your opinion, now you, I guess you have some contact with the state county organizations throughout the state. Would you say Mahoning County is sort of representative of the state as a whole?
Well, they're all different. You know, in Cleveland, they have three county chairmen. And they're having difficulties up there in their party organization, probably because of three leaders. You know, they're difficult. We don't have that kind of a problem. Toledo, Calvin, who is the next city policeman there, is doing a good job of reforming their party and bringing it up from a very low point. So they have kind of a new thing. Columbus, there was some, you know, real confidence that went through in Columbus a couple years ago when they had a majority of Democrats elected to the city council. Cincinnati has become more Democrat in their council as well, I think. But by and large, I think Democrat organizations need some help in state. The Democrats don't seem to have at the state level someone that can go down and help at a local level. In other words, Republicans for a number of years always had strong state organization. Rick West was the chairman, and he was a, you know, kind of a pinnacle of power for the state Republican Party, and functioned very well for that. And Kent Magoo now has taken over, and it looks like, you know, doing a pretty good job as far as they're concerned. The Democrat Party in Ohio, what Gilligan was, when he was governor, he was the, you know, pinnacle of state political power, and when he was defeated, it just left a tremendous power vacuum. And so we now have, you know, left to follow in the clips from Dayton, you know, that he was promising, if he can put the time in, you know, to kind of get everything together and get the chairman working together and trying to get, you know, some enthusiasm for getting local mayors elected, you know, local councilmen elected. Because that's the only way you build a good, strong state party is to have strong local parties. So I think that's the challenge of the Democratic Party today.
Now, course, you're working under Rhodes now. Beside the fact that Gilligan's removal left a big gap, what other changes have you noticed since Rhodes come?
They're completely different kind of people. Jack Gilligan was came from the academic community. We had a lot of academic people around him. And that probably, you know, was his downfall to a certain extent, because it was very difficult for ordinary working people to relate to academic people for some reason. They may share some common political interests, but communication just wasn't there. And so we kind of believe that it's isolated them, and he was not open to going out shaking hands with people, and, you know, really being, he kind of was pent up in his little office. Rhodes was a glad hand and a backslapper. He'd shake hands with everybody, you know, and I'd been in two meetings with Rhodes already. This is March 10th, I guess. And I can only remember one meeting with Jack Gilligan the whole time I was there. We were living at Lake Milton. So, you know, Rhodes has a much more active, you know, getting around meeting kind of thing in terms of, at least with the legislature, you know. And, but Gilligan is the kind of guy though where you could sit down and talk about an issue. You know, you could sit down and have some dialogue about issues. Rhodes is the kind of guy, he comes in, sits down, tells you what he wants, and gets up and leaves. And there's no, you know, no dialogue at all. And so there is the difference. Rhodes is not a kind of guy that defends himself by arguing with you about an issue. He'll just ignore it. In other words, he'll come in with his proposal. You might have another proposal. He'll just ignore your proposal. He'll just go along with what they're his things. He's not going to waste your time. You know, I'm trying to figure out how he ticks. And I believe that what his approach is that I'll tell him what I want to do, and I'll work for that, and ignore
what he's with everybody. Yeah. Democrats,
oh,
everybody.
Sure, yeah. Funny guy, you know. We had a meeting with him, the Democrat leadership, and he said, this is the management operation here. He says, everybody starts 7:30. He says, slap them on the ass with turpentine, away they go.
Can you get him talking to people like that?
Well, I mean,
especially he's talking
to the legislature. I mean, that's his, you know, when you look at his campaign and size things up, you know, here's a guy that came out, I think, southeastern Ohio, which is a rather poverty part of Ohio. And he was really never much on social issues, you know. He's always big on building things, but social issues, that wasn't his where he was very heavy. And the people that he come from are people that really need, the city liberal might think that the people he comes from need a lot of help in education and mental health and medical, you know. But those people supported him. They didn't support Jack Gilligan, who was kind of, you know, worked a lot to raise their education standards and some of these other things. And you wonder, you know, it really kind of does make you think that the people that Gilligan tried to support, his administration was directed to, really didn't get anything. And so it makes you try and analyze why you don't get that, why you didn't get a response back from the people that you were, you know, you were geared to help. So then you have to kind of think, well, maybe help comes in different ways. You know, maybe it's not just financial help and some of these other things that they want. I think it was Jim Rhodes' campaign ads that you said he was a coal miner and he scratched on his belly. And I suppose a guy to talk like that related more than, you know, the Undertaker's son that went to Notre Dame and came from a wealthy Cincinnati family could. Maybe that's more important.
Almost like a Democratic image to a Republican.
Maybe it's just that, you know, maybe the people want a candidate they can relate to more than someone that might look at their problems in a paternalistic way rather than someone that wouldn't look at them with paternalism, but would look at them as another one from them, you know. In other words, I come from I come from the coal mines of southeastern Ohio, and I know what it's like to live down there. I know how rough it is. And, you know, this is how I made a success in my life.
What's the feeling in the House, though? Are they prepared to relate to him in this way?
Well, the House, you know, started off with trying to do some things while Gilligan was still governor in terms of congressional redistricting plan to try and
make the congressional districts relate more to the population, and some other pieces of legislation that we haven't been able to get passed because the Republican-controlled Senate didn't vote them out for the governor to sign. So now we have a Democrat Senate as long as with the Democrat House and a Democrat governor. We tried to get them all passed right away so Gilligan would sign them and they would become law, which are now, of course, in the courts. And some place along the line, when someone's reading this, the decision will have been made, you know. And so then that issue was, we started off with that issue. Then we went into Rhodes Bond proposal, which is a whole new issue. You know? So we really haven't had a time to. I think he's just going to come out with his stuff. And, you know, whatever we get up on his desk, he'll deal with. But we're going to have to get into it before he's going to, I think, say too much about it.
Last December, we got word around here about you becoming whip, Democratic Majority Whip. What was all involved in this? How do you
putting it together?
How do you put that together?
Well, first of all, it was funny. I'm in Columbus, and the House was not in session. But I was invited to go to lunch. And so I was sitting there, and the Speaker, the House Speaker, was there, and a couple other fellows, and they were talking about campaign for the leadership. My name is thrown at this fellow would be this, and the other fellow would be something else, and I'm trying to be whip. I'm just a freshman, you know, I've been real, but I was just fresh as enough. Why would they want to pick me, a freshman, to be whip? So I kind of left it, you know, not really, there wasn't any comment made by the Speaker at the time, and so I just let it pass. But I did support Vern Reich right away, get a letter, and sent a letter to him saying I supported him, sent a letter to Lanciano, told him that I supported Mr. Reich because I felt that we should have another change, and not that I was dissatisfied with him, but Reich had some ambitions, you know, later on, and I felt that we got to give, he needed to be Speaker now in order to get himself known throughout the state if he wanted to run for governor, you know, in 4 years. He couldn't do it in 2 years, and A.G. Lanciano wanted to be Speaker these 2 years, then give it up to Vern Reich, which means that Reich would only be Speaker for 2 years and still want to maybe be a candidate for governor. I have a particular philosophy that we should get as many people in a position of running as possible. We should have abundance of candidates, and whoever is the strongest will surface and will, you know, be a candidate. Maybe it'd be Vern Reich, maybe it'd be Brown, maybe it'd be Ferguson, you know, maybe somebody that we're not thinking about right now. But I felt he should have that opportunity. So I did support him, basically for those reasons, and also because he's done so much work, you know, the last 2 years in getting Democrat policy, really doing a lot of the work of the Speaker. So I support him. I made those opinions known to both people, and I think they both respect me for AG. Respecting me because I told him right away where I was, and even, you know, a lot of people were wishy-washy. So, ultimately, a friend of mine said to me, he said, do you want to be whip or do you want to be a chairman of the committee? I said, well, if I have that choice, I'll take the whip. And so that's exactly how it happened. Now, why he picked me, I don't know. There were a couple other fellows that were interested. Sometimes, you know, you don't really know why things happen to you. You just happen to be at the right place at the right time. And I suppose to a certain extent that's what happened in that case. So, you know, you're down there, really, and you look at everybody, you know, all the legislators. You start dealing with governors, you start dealing with governors and governor's aides and senators. And you find out that people are not any more intelligent any place you go. You're just operating at a different level, but they're just human beings. They're just, you know, they have the same emotions and their intellectual ability is, you know, they're not super geniuses at all. And it's a very human kind of thing. And you just, you know, you sit back and you, from, you know, a vantage point of here, you start looking at a guy that's the governor of the state of Ohio. Boy, you know, that's really something to be governed. Then when you get to know them, say, well, you know, that guy's any smarter than I am. And, you know, he's no more aware of, he has no more talents than I do, or the people, you know, my friends do, or the people that I associate with. So then you start to realize that these people just, they come right from, you know, the sidewalks of America. And sometimes the media, in a way, when it takes them and, you know, puts a camera on them and they're talking, and, you know, it kind of, I suppose, it puts them into the same mainstream as you have, you know, some other people, you know, TV characters and a lot of other, that's all a big thing coming across to the public.
Well, what separates them, though? What makes them?
They take a chance. They take a chance. I'd say, I'm going to go for it. You know, Jack Gilligan was a city councilman. And I think he ran for Congress because the district had changed. And he won. Then they changed the district again. Then he lost. Then he ran for councilman again. And he won that. And then he was a councilman. I guess during that time he was a councilman, did a lot of talking for against the right to work law. So they made friends with labor. So they said, well, I'm going to run against Frank Lasher. And he ran and beat Frank Lasher in the primary because he had labor support. He lost in the general election, but he said, you know, why should a councilman from Cincinnati run against a guy like Frank Lasher, who was, you know, supposed to be super tough? So he just took a chance. And ultimately, it made him governor because, you know, the exposure of running for Senate made him better known to run for governor 2 years later, and there happened to be a loan scandal in the Republican administration. He probably didn't win the election. The Republicans lost it because of the loan scandal, just like Governor Rhodes said they lost him when he was down in his office a couple of times. He says, I didn't win the election. He said the other side lost. And that happens a lot of times. Guys don't win, the other side loses.
Well, for example, what do you think the police scandal, what effect would that have on others?
I don't think it would have any effect because I don't think people relate that to him. I don't think they believe that he condoned it or had anything to do with it. Or, you know, I think that basically they had confidence in him, his honesty. You know, he's gonna have, you know, he's gonna have to do something to, you know, I think he's got that. People have confidence in him. I think they believe he's honest, and I personally believe he's honest. And he hasn't done anything to prove that he isn't. And so when something like that happens, it doesn't hurt him. And I think if people didn't trust him, then that, you know, an issue like that would have another effect.
Well, could you relate that, say, to a stop five incident? Could you draw a parallel there?
Well, I think that, you know, at that point in time, there was discontent about the administration. And so, you know, then another incident happens, and so people say, well, you know, the whole thing is a bad experience. And that was kind of different, and it was violence, and, you know, there were a lot of people involved in that. It was rather ugly, and the people sometimes, you know, in order to get rid of something, they throw everything out. That was never, I don't think, ever really investigated properly. I don't think that all the problems in that area were ever put out on the front burner for everybody to see. I wasn't there. I don't know anything about it. But, you know, I had a feeling that that was never completely dealt with.
Okay. I heard you talking about rising up on the state level. What would it take to rise up in the Democratic Party locally? What do you see? What qualities a person needs?
Well, I think one thing is that if a person wanted to be a public official in the city of Youngstown, they would have to run for city council and get elected. And then from that base, they would have to prove to be a person that can make a decision, you know, and also a person that has innovative ideas. You know, I think people want someone that can come up with some ideas. Not just someone that responds all the time, but is creative. I think people are looking for some creative public officials. A lot of times, people, especially in the legislative branch, they just want to respond all the time. That's why I try and come up with ideas. I try and present, you know, present new things. But, you know, I try and do the positive rather than responding what other people, you know, give me to decide on. That's how I got into this whole energy thing.
Is this appreciated by the party?
Well, I don't. Well, first of all, if you were a Democrat and you had a Republican mayor, you need to come up with a lot of ideas that would make the administration respond to you. Here's a guy who's got some ideas. He's an idea man. He's going to make government better because he's got some things to help people respond to problems. He just sits back and waits for the administration to solve all the problems and say yes or no. Now, I don't think he can get anywhere that way. I don't think he can get up front. I think he has to try and sell some ideas. So I think people are looking for that kind of guy, because that's the kind of person they want to be an executive man, someone that has some ideas on solving problems. Because when you get out of the executive branch, whether you're a mayor or a county commissioner or governor, you've got to put some solutions to problems. And you have to know how to do that.
Now, in the Democratic Party, Mahoning County, we know Mr. Soligan is a very powerful person. Who are the other people with power within the party, the people to see about something being done?
Well, I'm not so sure that power rests like that, with one person. I think that a lot of the power has to do with people that contribute. People are interested in who's going to fund campaigns. So all the groups that provide funds for running for office have a sphere of influence. So, it's just not, I think, you can't run for office unless you have the funds to do it. So therefore you find that, there are some labor people that are powerful politically, some business people that are powerful politically, and then you also have, Mr. Soligan, who's chairman of the Democrat Party. But by himself, I don't think that he's powerful in terms of getting a Democrat organization lined up and with you and all this kind of thing. But he's not going to give you anything to run for election. The Democrat Party does not finance candidates. So he has to go to other people to get the funds to run. And so because of that, other people are important. People in the labor movement in particular are important politically.
Anything else you want to say about the party in the area? Any other comments you'd like to make?
No, I don't think so. I think a lot of times everybody wants to talk about reforming everything. Well, you don't find, I think sometimes that probably the best way to describe a political party at the local level is that it's pretty much represents the thinking of the people. Whatever that might be, and when the thinking changes, the party structures will change. People are pretty much used to the kind of party organization that we have here, and by and large, I think they accept it.
Okay, thank you very much.